CBC Radio 2. Now on Radio 2, the second installment in our series of Ian Fleming's James Bond stories. Damian Lewis reads the concluding part of The Living Daylights. James Bond is holed up in a tower block in Berlin, awaiting his victim, a KGB sniper on the tail of a British agent. D-Day has arrived and 007 must get to work.
Bond drew the curtains to let in the grey Prussian day, and standing well back from the window, gazed out at the drabness of Berlin. He gave a quick, reluctant glance at what he had examined the night before, noted the weeds among the bomb rubble, and then went into the kitchen. There was a note. "Your gear," double talk for Bond's rifle, "has arrived and the Batman will lay it out this PM. Peace, Ender." Bond lit the gas cooker, burned the message with a sneer at his profession, and then brewed himself a vast dish of scrambled eggs and bacon, which he heaped on buttered toast and washed down with black coffee, into which he had poured a liberal tot of whiskey. Then he bathed and shaved, dressed, looked at his disordered bed, decided to hell with it, and went down in the lift. It was cold outside. Bond, closing his mind to the evening, debated with himself about ways to spend the afternoon. It finally came down to a strenuous walk in the Grunewald. The pretty young trees round the long lake had already been touched by the breath of autumn, and there was occasional gold among the green. Bond walked hard for 2 hours along the leafy paths. Then, feeling more encouraged, he took the S-Bahn back into the city. Outside the apartment house, a nondescript young man was tinkering with the engine of a black Opel Capitan. He didn't take his head out from under the bonnet when Bond passed close by. It was a corporal from the transport section of Station WB. Each night, he would be ready to produce a series of multiple backfires when a signal on a walkie-talkie operated by sender told him to do so. This would give some kind of cover for the noise of Bond's shooting. Otherwise, the neighbourhood might alert the police, and there would be a lot of untidy explaining to be done. Bond was impressed by the preparations that had been made for him in the living room. A stand had been erected against the windowsill, and along it lay the Winchester, the tip of its barrel just denting the curtains. The rifle had been painted a dull black, and laid out on the bed like sinister evening clothes was a black velvet hood, a waist-length shirt of the same material. The hood had wide slits for the eyes and mouth. Captain Sender, his face worried and tense, said there was no news, no change in the situation as they knew it. Did Bond want anything to eat? Perhaps a tranquilizer. Bond stitched a cheerful expression on his face and said, "No thanks," gave a light-hearted account of his day while an artery near his solar plexus began thumping gently as tension built up inside him like a watch spring tightening. Finally, his small talk petered out and he lay down on his bed. It was 5:30. Time to take up their positions. Bond took off his coat and tie, put two sticks of chewing gum in his mouth, and donned the hood. The lights were switched off by Captain Sender, and Bond lay along the bed and gently lifted the bottom edge of the curtain back and over his shoulders. The scene was like a well-remembered photograph. The wasteland, the frontier road, and on the left, the ugly square block of the Haus der Ministerien. Bond looked at the four windows, dark again tonight, that he agreed with Sender were the enemy's firing points. There was no sign of movement within the oblong, gaping mouths. The women's orchestra came trooping down the pavement towards the entrance, 20 laughing girls carrying their instruments. Bond picked out the girl carrying the cello. His jaws stopped still and then reflectively went on with their chewing. The girl was taller than the others, and her long, straight hair shone like gold under the arcs at the intersection. She was vivid with movement and life. As she turned in at the entrance, the arcs momentarily caught a beautiful, pale profile. And then she was gone, and it seemed to Bond with her disappearance, a stab of grief lanced into his heart. How odd! This had not happened to him since he was young. and now this single girl had caused him this thrill of animal magnetism. Morosely, Bond glanced down at his watch. 5:50. Only 10 minutes to go. No transport arriving at the entrance. None of those anonymous black Zik saloons he had half expected. He closed as much of his mind as he could to the girl and sharpened his wits. Get on, damn you, get back to your job. From inside the ministry came the sounds of tuning up. Then a pause, and then the whole orchestra threw itself into the opening bars. The Polopsian dances, said Captain Sender. And then urgently, hey, right-hand bottom of the four windows, watch out. From the interior, a weapon had slid out. It moved minutely, swivelling so as to cover the stretch of the Zimmerstrasse between the two wastelands of rubble. What is it? What sort of gun? Captain Sender's voice was breathless. Take it easy, damn it, thought Bond. It's me who's supposed to have the nerves. Kalashnikov, he said curtly. Submachine gun. We'll have to get him pretty quick, or 272 will end up not just dead, but strawberry jam. He'll have to show himself to fire. Other chaps are probably spotting behind him, perhaps from all four windows. Bond fiddled minutely with the screws at his fingertips and got the fine lines of the scope exactly intersected, just behind where the butt of the enemy gun merged into the blackness behind. Get the chest. Don't bother about the head. Inside the hood, Bond's face began to sweat. That didn't matter. It was only his trigger finger that must stay bone dry. As the minutes ticked by, he frequently blinked his eyes to rest them, listened to the music to relax his mind. The minutes slouched on leaden feet. How old would she be? Early 20s. That poise and insouciance, the hint of authority in her long, easy stride. Captain Sender said, 7 o'clock. Nothing stirred on the other side. Better stay with it until they close down. Let me know when they take that gun in. It was 7:30 when the KGB submachine gun was gently drawn back into the black interior. One by one, the bottom sashes of the four windows were closed. The cold-hearted game was over for the night. 272 was still holed up. Two more nights to go. The next day and the next night watch were duplicates with small variations of the first. James Bond had two more rendezvous by sniper scope with the girl, and the rest was a killing of time and a tightening of the tension that by the time the third and final day came was like a fog in the small room. Bond narrowly averted a row with Captain Sender because he had poured himself a stiff whiskey before putting on the hideous cowl that now stank of his sweat. Sender had threatened to call up head of section and report Bond for breaking training. Look, my friend, said Bond wearily. I've got to commit a murder tonight, not you, me. Think I like this job? I'd be quite happy for you to get me sacked from the 00 section, then I could settle down and make a snug nest of papers as an ordinary staffer, right? Bond drank down his whiskey. Sender, icily silent, went off into the kitchen. It was exactly 6:05. Bond, there's something moving over there. Now he's stopped. Wait. No, he's on the move again. Any reaction? No, said Bond tensely. Keep on telling me. How far to the frontier? He's only got about 50 yards to go. Sender's voice was harsh with excitement. Then a solid chunk of wool. They'll have to get over it. They can't fail to spot him then. Get ready. Any moment now, he'll make the last sprint. Bond felt the sweat pouring down his face. There's something moving in the room behind the gun. They must have spotted him. Get that opal working. Bond heard the code word go into the microphone, heard the opal in the street below start up, felt his pulse quicken as a series of ear-splitting cracks came from the exhaust. The movement in the black cave was now definite. A black arm with a black glove had reached out and under the stock. Now! He's run for the wall! He's up it! He's going to jump! And then, in the sniperscope, Bond saw the head of Trigger. The purity of the profile. The golden bell of hair. She was dead, a sitting duck. Bond's fingers flashed down to the screws, inched them round, and as yellow flame fluttered at the snout of the submachine gun, squeezed the trigger. The bullet, dead on at 310 yards, must have hit where the stock ended up the barrel. Might have got her in the left hand, but the effect was to tear the gun off its mountings and hurl it out of the window. It crashed into the street. "He's over!" shouted Sender. "He's done it! My God, he's done it!" "Get down!" said Bond sharply, and threw himself off the bed as a searchlight in one of the black windows blazed on, swerving up towards their room. Then gunfire crashed and the bullets howled into their window, ripping the curtains, smashing the woodwork, thudding into the walls. Behind the roar of the bullets, Bond heard the Opel race off down the street, and behind that again the orchestra. Of course! The orchestra had probably been used, like the backfiring Opel on this side, to provide cover for a sharp burst of fire on their side by trigger. Had she carried her weapon to and fro every day in the cello case? In the sniper scope, Bond had even been able to see one wide, heavily lashed, aiming eye. Had he hurt her? Almost certainly her left arm. There would be no chance of seeing her, seeing how she was, if she left with the orchestra. He would never see her again. Captain Sender emerged, brushing glass out of his hair. They crunched across the floor, into the kitchen. Here, away from the street, it was safe to switch on the light. "Any damage?" asked Bond. "No. No, you all right?" Sender's pale eyes were bright with the fever that comes in battle. They also, Bond noticed, held a sharp glint of accusation. "Yes, just get an elastoplast for my hand, caught a splash from one of the bullets." Bond went into the bathroom. When he came out, Sender was sitting by the walkie-talkie he had fetched from the sitting room. He was speaking into it. "That's all for now. Hurry the armoured car. Be glad to get out of here. Okay? Then over and out." Sender turned to Bond. Half accusing, half embarrassed, he said, "Afraid head of station needs your reasons in writing for not getting that chap. I had to tell him I'd seen you alter your aim at the last second. Gave trigger time to get off a burst. Damned lucky for 272, he'd just begun his sprint. What was it all about?" Bond knew he could fake a dozen reasons why. Instead, he took a deep pull at the whiskey he had poured for himself and looked Captain Sender in the eye. Trigger was a woman.
"So what? KGB have got plenty of women gunners."
"She was the girl who carried the cello in that orchestra."
"Oh," said Sender slowly. "I see. The girl you were keen on."
"That's right."
"Well, I'm sorry, but I'll have to put that in my report, too. You had clear orders to exterminate Trigger."
There came the sound of a car. The bell rang twice. Sender said, "Let's get going." He paused.
"Sorry about the report. Got to do my duty, you know."
Bond got up. For 3 days he had had this long-range, one-sided romance with an unknown girl. An agent with much the same job as his. Poor little bitch. She would be in worse trouble now than he was. Probably be kicked out of the KGB. He shrugged. At least they'd stop short of killing her, as he himself had done. Bond said wearily, "Okay. With any luck, it'll cost me my 00 number. But tell head of station not to worry. That girl won't do any more sniping. Probably lost her left hand. Scared the living daylights out of her. In my book, that was enough. Let's go."
Part 2 of The Living Daylights by Ian Fleming was read by Damien Lewis and produced by Joanna Green. The executive producer was Liz Anstey, and it was a Cellador production for BBC Radio 2. Next week, part 1 of From a View to a Kill.